of you were not here on Monday. Okay, it's about half of you. So this is always a dilemma up here, you know, when we do these courses, because some people want part of one thing, part of another. So I'm going to go through some of the slides here that I did on Monday. I'm not going to spend as much time on them as I did, and won't take a long time on introducing myself again. Basically, just for those of you who don't know me, the short story is that after doing my undergraduate work at Chico State, I went for a year at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Was at PLPS and actually sort of on track to do ministry in the Lutheran Church, and then transferred to Yale Divinity School. There I worked with George Lindbeck and someone who was really popular in Catholic circles, a guy named Henry Nouwen. And he actually sponsored a project that I did on Vincent van Gogh when I was there, a multimedia production thing that he did. And I had a couple of experiences that led me to realize that I was not a pastor in the making. One was spending a seminar with retired pastors, where I decided that this work was just too difficult for me. So I went into education instead. The other was I worked for a year at Yale New Haven Hospital in the cancer unit. It wasn't because of the suffering where I was affronted by, you know, the fact that these people, that God could heal them or something, and he did it. It was not that, but that experience did kind of make some difference to me. I think all but one per people in this program, it's called Clinical Pastoral Education, it was a 9-month thing. I think all of them but one did not go into the ministry, in fact, and I'm not sure if there's any connection between that or that experience or not, I hope not. But it was basically that I found that that people who were dying just weren't interested in the things they thought they might be interested in. You know, I thought they might be interested in really resolving questions like, you know, is there life after death? Did Jesus really raise from the dead? Is he walk on water? And all those kinds of things. But really, it was a lot more about trying to make sense of their own life. You know, once they got through the chaplain badge, really wanting me to help them connect the dots of their life, coming back to these stories that seem to be connected, but not really being able to put them together on their own. And I would help create this narrative of this life. Also, to the very end, doing really amateurish marital counseling, things like that, where there was an increasing sense of urgency in resolving conflict in people's lives and resolving family problems and so on. That seemed to be the real focus, not, you know, what's going to happen, which, you know, was surprising to me. So it wasn't my faith was challenged, it just was kind of shifted in realizing where people really were spending most of their psychological time and thinking about things. So then I went on to do a doctoral degree. I happened just lucky, you know, like it happened to somebody else, actually. There was a professor there from Oxford University, Morris Wiles. His son turned out to be a very famous mathematician, Andrew Wiles, who solved the Fermat mathematical problem, if you know anything about mathematics. Because of him, I decided when I was looking for graduate schools, he said, well, why don't you apply to Oxford, too? I said, what? Yeah, sure. So I applied to Oxford and did my philosophy degree then at Oxford at Christ Church. That MDiv part of me, though, that pastoral side of me certainly came through, because once I ended up at Pacific University, really a teaching college, teaching and service-oriented college, I was able to sort of direct my professional energies into what my profession calls public philosophy, which is to take the training and the work that I did as a graduate student to put those to work on solving problems within various professions. For example, we used to work a lot with Rich Gerling, actually, who's here, police executives, on the impact of national security issues on local law enforcement, for example. This is a very difficult, complex issue where ICE wants to try and get local government and local police to become agents for people. And they still don't, I don't think people really understand the difference between administrative and criminal law. Administrative law and criminal law, right? People mash those up together, and it's not a good thing. So they didn't want to be involved in dealing with immigration and local law enforcement for good reasons, especially in California and Oregon. So many undocumented workers and so on. Where what would otherwise be a routine kind of traffic stop ends up in a high-speed chase. And people end up not reporting domestic violence, people not afraid to go to hospitals, and so on and so forth. So we dealt with those issues. We also dealt with immigration issues. We had a program called People Without Papers and so on. So that's my heart and soul, really, is in public philosophy rather than writing articles for other philosophers where I might get, you know, maybe 12 people to read them. And, that might make me angry, but it really doesn't make me feel like I'm doing something valuable with my trainings. And that's why I'm here and why this subject has interested me. The larger picture here, too, in terms of the of genetics, the framework put it in. What I was going to say is that the larger framework is technology and how it can disappoint us.
Before.
It did work before. And it will work again. But again, this is what happens, right? We're all in a certain space, right? Now we're distracted. We have to reclaim that. That's what technology does to us, as well as for us, right? So, I'll just try the mouse. I just don't think I should go through all of this again. I'll just make a couple of remarks what I'm trying to do here and say is that technology, that my big concern that led to us, what I should have said as part of the introduction here, is that in 2004, a colleague of mine, Lisa Sardini in the biology department, and I put in a proposal to the National Institutes of Health to do a project, a public outreach on genetic and genetic technologies, and genetic science and genetic technologies. The money that was there was largely the result of a campaign by James Watson, about five people who actually discovered DNA, the structure of the DNA. This was the Genome Project in 1989, 1990. Went to Congress and said, we need to map the whole human genome. We need to map it, right? But he was smart enough to realize that this is science that was going to have a huge cultural impact. And it was going to also have a huge cultural impact, particularly on communities of faith. And he put out this idea that he wanted 4%, it was an increase to 6%, of the budget that they were going to use to do the Genome Project be put into projects that are called the ethical, legal, and social implications, right, of these genetic science and technology. We put in a proposal to do this, and they rejected it the first time around, because one reviewer said that, look, there's no diversity. You're targeting 21 religious communities, but they're all Christians, so there's no diversity in this project. You know, so you need to change that. And then another reviewer sent us a report that said, you got too much diversity in this project. How are you possibly going to manage Quakers and Unitarians? And, you know, how are you going to manage this group? You know? So we wrote back and revised the proposal a little bit and explained to them why we were sticking with our original proposal, that we had plenty of diversity the first time around on this, and we were granted over $250,000 to do a two-year project with 21 religious groups in the Portland area. But he knew that the technology, this wasn't a neutral technology. This was a technology that had an enormous power. The two symbols for the 20th century really is that the mushroom cloud and the helical double helix of DNA. They both have the power to create and to destroy. In fact, I'm going to show you a few quotes from a recent article in the New York Times about the power. Just quickly set this in as quickly as I can, a kind of philosophical, theological framework here to understand a little bit of the concepts within which we're dealing with this genetic technology. Talking about Augustine here and Aquinas, maybe most of you know who St. Augustine of Hippo is, right? And Thomas Aquinas. In Christianity, we originally had the Hebrew Bible, right? You have the Hebrew Old Testament. And that at some point got translated into Greek. Well, Greek was steeped in the concepts of Plato, right? So we have this connection between Augustine and Plato. Christian theology is deeply rooted in Platonic kind of categories. Now, why is that important? If you think about Plato, and you combine it with sort of the story of the Israelites, right? You end up with this picture, this story, which is the story of a journey. Turns out Paul did not write Hebrews, but in Hebrews, you've got a lot of emphasis on the journey of life, for life is a journey. Well, Plato is that way. If you don't know anything else about Plato, you know about the image of the cave, right? The cave where these people who are trapped in the cave and all they see are shadows of puppets, right? And eventually someone comes down and releases them from their chains and they slowly adjust their eyes until they journey out of the cave and they finally arrive at reality, the truth, the sun, light, you know. That's this sort of the image from Plato, the idea that we're born into the world with a distillate of our origins and that we spend our lives looking to find our way back home. That's what life is all about, is this journey that's put in us as an impetus to find our way home. Well, Augustine takes this over, attaches it in a way to the Israelite. It's the story of the Israelites and salvation, homecoming, the establishment of Israel, the kingdom of God coming, is coming, and so on. So that this journey, right, this idea of a journey in Christianity, he attaches it to this idea. And so he even uses phrases like the Bible are love letters from home. They're letters from home. You know, again, the idea of we're being called home, journey. Well, one thing this does is it emphasizes something and it de-emphasizes something. What it emphasizes is this imperative that we find our way, make our way through life in a way that is fully embedded with moral conviction, being the kind of people who are worthy of homecoming, right? We have all of this emphasis. What it de-emphasizes are the particulars, the details. When we talk about science here, it's not that there was no science that was done from Plato on, right, or from Augustine through scientific revolution. But we call it a scientific revolution for a reason. And that's because in Augustine, we have this idea that it doesn't matter, you know. The beauty that we see up here, all this stuff, is not. We don't want to look at the details of the mountains and the falls up here, the beautiful animals and so on. We don't find God in those things. These are, as Shakespeare would say, this is the stage, the set. What's important is our salvation. So he's not going to be spending a lot of time like Aristotle and Aquinas did. He's not going to spend a lot of time analyzing all the details of nature and so on. It's a waste of spiritual time, right, being a scientist in that sense, right? And again, I'm oversimplifying everything here. It's not as though there's no science. It's just de-emphasized in Augustine because of this picture, right? Fast forward then to Aquinas in the 13th century, an amazing, amazing figure. You cannot overstate the implications of what happened in the 13th century for our consciousness, our modern consciousness. Why? Because at the beginning of Aquinas' life, at the beginning of his life, Aristotle was a forbidden philosopher. He wasn't to be read, he was banned. By the end of Aquinas' life, largely because of Aquinas' work, he was required reading. Aristotle had been lost and had been picked up and translated amongst the Islamic scholars, Avicenna and so on. They picked him up and used Aristotle in developing their Islamic philosophy of religion. But the Christianity had not absorbed it. So in the 13th century, all these texts were coming in, and we knew a lot more about Aristotle. Now, at the same time that Islam was finally getting to the point where they were distrusting Aristotle and getting rid of Aristotle, Aquinas was absorbing it, and it became the dominant way of thinking to absorb Christian themes. And if you look here, which is a great way of doing this pictorially, this is called the School of Athens. Does anyone know this painting at all? Yeah. So 1510 Raphael. Who you have in the center there is not Jesus or Moses. It looks like Moses and Jesus maybe in there or something, right, in the middle. That's Plato and Aristotle. There's Aristotle, or Plato, barefoot, older. He's pointing up to the sky, right? He's got the Timaeus in his hands, which is a metaphysics text. And then you have Aristotle here with the Nicomachean Ethics, and his hand is pointing down. Aristotle's pointing up. Plato's pointing up. Aristotle is pointing down. Go back to the other slide here. I think it's easier if I do it on this side. Where is this? Does anyone know where this painting is located?
Sistine Chapel.
Close. Certainly in the Vatican. It was the Vatican Library. The same time that Raphael was painting this, there was another painter working in the Sistine Chapel. Anyone know that name? Everyone knows Michelangelo, right? So this is Julius II who commissioned both of them to do these. This is what we call the Renaissance, right? Now this is in the Vatican Library. And it's not Jesus and Moses in there. It's Aristotle and Plato. And you have every possible scholar from all over the world in here that are working together collaboratively to understand the world. This is Aristotle again, you know, this down. So there's an openness to the world, and openness to nature, whole concept of natural theology, that even without revelation, that we can find evidence of God in the world. And if we study the world hard enough and faithfully enough, we'll find God there. So the Vatican had no problem having these two be in the middle of the Vatican Library, right, as being an important concept. You couldn't have painted this even 10 years before. This wouldn't take 10 years. You couldn't have painted it 100 years before. This is the attitude of Christianity was changing dramatically from Augustine to Aquinas because of Plato and Aristotle. So here's what happened then, big time. He's all up here quickly so we can go faster. Right. Not long after, you know, this is Raphael's painting in the Renaissance, the period of Renaissance there, we get the scientific revelation. And it's like, boom, no one survived. You know, no one survived unaffected the scientific revolution. It's hard for us to grasp the extent to which the world changed because of certain things that happened. And then the intellectual overlay of understanding those things that happen. First, Copernicus. Copernicus came to the conclusion that the Earth revolves around the Sun. And it turns out that even the Sun's not the center of the universe. The Sun is just the star in a solar system that's in a huge galaxy. I didn't even know until 5 years ago or so that all the stars we see up there at night, all of them, are just in our galaxy, right? You have to have a little bit of a telescope to even see faint images of other galaxies. This makes a difference, you know, the idea that the Earth is at the center, the story is about us and only us, is changed here through, and Galileo confirms this with the aid of a telescope invented by a Dutchman in 1608, where he looked up through his telescope and he sees the moons around Jupiter. And he was also able to see the phases in Venus, which then proved that the Copernican theory was true. And yet, at the time, the religious authority was against Galileo on this, that they saw the implications of this, and he ended up in trouble because of his making these claims. But what does the scientific revolution then ultimately do, and do irreversibly and forever? What it does is it's saying that there are different kinds of authority. And it doesn't matter if you're a pope or not, you can't make the moons of Jupiter go away. Right? There's no framework from which you can challenge these kinds of things. So therefore, what then is raised to the level of popedom, in this sense, you know, what's raised to the level of authority high, a higher level of authority, is science. Maybe our salvation is in science. So, and then also William Harvey's circulation of the blood is also another kind of shocker, that we were just like all other animals with how our circulation system works. Now, one of the consequences is it didn't take long 1723 hears that it didn't take long for philosophers, sort of antithetical to religion, to jump on this these discoveries and end up with, from what are, from my point of view, cynical and naive and simplistic kinds of responses, or are coming to conclusions that really aren't necessarily in the, you know, in the data here. And so he ends up with saying this: if we go back to the beginning of things, we shall always find that ignorance and fear created the gods, that imagination, rapture, deception embellish them, that weakness worships them, that custom spares them, and that tyranny favors them in order to profit from the blindness of men. So that's religion. End of story, right? And if you read that, you start feeling, well, gosh, maybe I have faith just because I'm afraid, you know, you read that. And this is, from my point of view, again, a very kind of simplistic, naive, distorted read of what the scientific revolution meant. And a reaction to these here, this will get us right to the genetics now, right? A reaction to this religiously was either those who tried to keep the good fight, you know, to make sort of counterclaims against science, or to do science that's really, really dubious, that's strict, gymnastical science, they would call it, you know. People who want to have a theory, if you look hard enough and long enough, you can almost come up with at least some evidence for any theory, right? So they'll come up with ideas to try and explain away fossils or things like this, and to look at the evidence and come up with an alternative explanation. You've got all that group. They still do it. They still do that today, right? Then you have, you know, people who wanted to take on the science and turn it into another religion. And that's what's called Meliorism. M-E-L-I-O-R-I-S-M. Meliorism. And it's the belief, which is a kind of a religious ideological belief, that people with reason, rationality, goodwill, and technology, science, technology, inevitably produce progress. We are inevitably going to get constantly, the world has become better and better if we stick with the science, we develop the technology, make the technology work, we can create a world that the religions only dreamt of, you know, on some other planet, some other kind of space, heaven. We can do that ourselves here with reason and science. We don't need gods for this project. And then others who weren't religious per se, you know, maybe spiritual, but not necessarily religious, like Wordsworth, for example, the romantic poets. John Stuart Mill was a product of culture in which utilitarianism was the dominant view about ethics, and he was raised this way. And he talks about himself in some ways, even though he ended up being a prominent utilitarian himself, sort of his life being saved by Wordsworth. On this picture of the science that nearly crushed him. Another poet, romantic poet, is Percy Shelley. And guess what his wife's name is? Mary Shelley. And what book did she write?
Frankenstein.
Exactly. And what was the subtitle of the Frankenstein? I won't. Last yes, before I showed some little clips and things, I don't know if we'll read that now.
The Prometheus Myth.
So here's an alternative narrative to the scientific, to Meliorism, right? What's a Prometheus myth? Anyone know about this? You knew the word, you knew the name. He was a Titan, one of the Titans. And in the hierarchy of gods in Greece, that the Titans were sort of you have the supreme being, right? And then you have the second generation gods. Those are the Titans. From the Titans came the Olympians. Right, the Olympus, Zeus, and all those people there, right? So they're sort of these older gods. And Prometheus did two things that put him in disfavor with Zeus, the younger, supreme, powerful god, and the Greek pantheon, right? He did two things. One thing he did really bad is he created humans. That's one thing he did is not a good thing. Second thing he did wrong is he gave them technology. It's called fire. And for this, he was punished eternally by having him strapped to a cross and he would have an eagle that would come and eat his liver, slowly eat his liver all day long. The next day it would regenerate and he'd have to, you know, endure his liver being eaten by this eagle every day. So that's the Prometheus myth that steals the secret energies of the gods for man, to you, for men to use, right? And again, don't we have something similar to this in the Genesis story in a way? You know, the garden, that's the sort of the primal image of the good and the beautiful and order, everything that we long to return to, right? You have that. It's been ruined by a decision to go against what the structures are there for, and the taking of the fruit, and then the fall, you know, the fall of humanity. And it's, some call it the felix culpa, the fortunate fall. That then leads the way, that suffering, that fall, leads to the salvation, you know, to becoming Christ. There would have been no Christ had there been no, you know, eating of the apples, if we're. But the point here is that the idea then is that technology isn't necessarily a good thing at all. If you look hard enough and clear enough about what it means to be a human being, perhaps we are going to end up not only being just distracted with our technologies and enamored with our technologies, but destroyed by them. Aldous Huxley, if you want to read two books, you know, recommended by me, one is Aldous Huxley. And then the other is Neil Postman. It's a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death about technology. You can't do better than Neil Postman on the dangers of technology. And his point is that, well, first of all, Aldous Huxley's comment was, technology does nothing but create new and better, more effective ways for humanity to go backwards. That's his comment on technology. Neil Postman says that we need to ask questions about technology before we absorb them. And I think we all feel this sense, even up here, this conflict between the need for us to be surrounded by our technologies, the phones that we've got strapped on. Mm-hmm. Where is my phone? You know, what I'm saying is that every, you know, if it's missing for 15 minutes or so, I get a little edgy, right? Something's wrong. Something has gone wrong, and we know that the technologies are doing something for us, right? But at some point, we realize that they're also doing something to us. And once we realize that they're doing something to us, we feel like the technologies are now embedded like nature and are immovable, that we can't change and extract ourselves from those negative side effects. And unfortunately, we're at a point where these technologies have become so advanced, so sophisticated, and so powerful that we're really at, from my point of view, and I'm not by nature an alarmist, right? Mm-hmm. But that we're at a point where we're going to have to do something different than we're doing if we want to have a future. Mm-hmm. And again, that sounds pretty dramatic. I guess it is, but I'll stand by that.
Which of Huxley's books?
Called
Brave New World.
Yeah, Brave New World. Brave New World. I saw somebody reading it on the boat coming up here. I couldn't believe it. You know, right. People would actually be reading that. Brave New World. And can we see it? Okay, I'm not going to show. This is just a Frankenstein story where in this clip they take him all the way up into above the building, and then the lightning hits him, and then he comes back down, and he's alive. Right? It's that scene where he's alive. This is a quote from the Phaedrus. Plato's Phaedrus, about a technology that he thought was destructive and dangerous, right? So here, this is a story, an ancient story about this king, famous, that is responding to his scientific assistant there, Thut, who then presents him with different things, technologies the king decides to absorb or not. And he says, Thut, my paragon of inventors, the discoverer of art is not the best judge of the good or harm which will accrue to those who practice it. But the scientists aren't necessarily the ones we should go to look for authority to, right, for how to use the science. You who are the father of writing, this is about the technology of writing, have, out of fondness for your offspring, just, you know, digs this new thing where you can actually write things down and save them. So he says, attribute to it quite the opposite of its real function. Those who acquire it will cease to exercise their memory and become forgetful. They will rely on writing to bring things to their remembrance by external signs, instead of by their own internal resources. What you have discovered is a receipt for recollection, not for memory. You've got the entire Library of Congress in your pocket.
My comment is, if it wasn't for the discovery of writing, you would not be able to quote that.
That's right.
Would not go to oral memory that long.
This is the paradox. Mm-hmm. The paradox of technology does stuff for us and also does stuff to us. It's not as though there's a simple sort of answer to these questions. You're absolutely right. And here's what he says, though, and as for wisdom, your pupils will have the reputation for it without the reality. They will receive a quantity of information without proper instruction, and consequently, but very knowledgeable when they are, for the most part, quite ignorant. And because they are filled with a conceit of wisdom instead of real wisdom, it will become a burden to society. Now, again, responding to my colleague here, that we're not going to give up writing, are we, anytime soon? I don't think so.
No, but this quote is very, very apt. You know, just because you're educated doesn't mean you're wise.
It's what?
Just because you're educated doesn't really know you.
That's
your
point.
Wise.
That's
you
the
have
point.
A degree, here.
That's right. Just because you have the knowledge, and in this case, he's saying that one of the things you sacrifice by going from an oral to a written culture is you diminish your. It's like GPS. We now have GPS. We don't have to know anything of where to go. All we need to know is where our next turn is. Right. So,
oh yeah. Yes, we do. I find that very offensive. And one thing that's been offending me up to this point is that everything is the male point of view, except for Mary. Okay, everything is the male point of view. And if you don't, in your younger years, become educated with information, how do you ever make your way make your way through life to the point of acquiring wisdom?
Right, so I guess one way to put it would be in this way, to reconcile the two positions here, might be to say something like, we decided that whatever sacrifices, whatever the deficits in not having writing, you know, the deficits we would have by not, we've decided that having the writing is much better than not having writing. Right? We've decided that this is for us. This is what the way we're going to go. Right? We'll see if Phil says anything about genetics. These are the things that, this is all that the postman wants to say. Ask the questions. Perhaps the best way to express it is, what will a new technology do is no more important than the question, what will a new technology undo? Right? Mm-hmm. And we were good at asking the first question, not so good at the second. And it's possible, this is plain. Idea two, the advantages and disadvantages of new technologies are never distributed evenly. This means every new technology benefits some and harms others. And embedded in every technology is a powerful idea, sometimes two or three powerful ideas. So he says, for example, for television, he said technological change is not additive, it's ecological. Meaning, it's like a little bit of ink. You do an ink drop in a bottle of water, or a glass of water, it disperses itself throughout all of the water. He says technology is like that. Mm-hmm. It's not like, and his book is largely about television. It's not that after television we had a United States that is now has television. We have a different United States. Mm-hmm. And he said it has had a profound impact and a negative impact, mm-hmm. A negative impact on three hugely important institutions, education, religion, in politics. Okay. He says that in part because of that new technology, it's made it difficult, if not impossible, to have a serious political discussion. Mm-hmm. And for religion to be something that's serious and sober and important. In education, he said, for example, I know this is maybe sounds offensive to you, but he says that Sesame Street never taught any kid to love anything about school. Mm-hmm. It taught them to learn to love television. And he said, as a result of that, education was changed forever because these kids grow up and expect Sesame Street when they go to school. My value is teaching evaluations. Everyone's evaluations, you know. Does he tell enough jokes? Does he keep you awake? In other words, we're sort of evaluated against Big Bird. And, you know, a lot of us are going to lose, you know, with all of that. So he's just saying that the technology is something that diffuses itself throughout our culture. And therefore, we need to have more. The way I put it is that we need to have techno-critique that's commensurate with the seriousness of the changes that the technology is going to produce. The Amish, for example, whatever else you think of them, seem to at least have some process for deciding whether or not some technology is actually going to further the identity, the meaning, and the mission of the community. If it's not, then they're not going to have it in it, as they can be persuaded that it's going to be of some use to the mission. And they're saying that usually what we do is that we throw the technology out there, see where it sticks, and see how what works, what doesn't work. Then at that point, at some point, it does begin to stick. We find like we can't unstick it anymore. Now we're stuck with it. Now what do we do? Mm-hmm. So that's a good point. So final idea is that technology tends to become what he calls mythic, and that just means part of nature. So I remember at one point in 1989 giving up television, and not giving up television in terms of just limiting my watching it, getting rid of the television set. You know, it's not in there anymore. And people were shocked, they couldn't understand, well, what do you do? It was like I said, I decided not to have a refrigerator in my home or something. Right? Television had become sort of a something that had to be in a house. It was as part, much part of the house as the refrigerator. Right? And it was hard. For about 3 months, I realized that, you know, kind of edgy and restless when I'd normally be just doing. And after 6 months, though, you know, like back, I'm thinking, well, what in the world was I spending my time? And I would hear someone hear television or hear that sound of a commercial or something, and just be, I can't believe that I was responding to all of that somehow. It took a while to get rid of, but it took, you know, you can't get rid of it. So he's just saying here, all of this stuff is to say that technologies are very easy to slip into, very hard to slip out of. John Paul up here, science can purify religion from error, and Galileo and so on. And superstition. Religion can purify science from idolatry and false absolutes. So that's our challenge and question for us today as people of faith, is what do we have to say and do in a world in which we are totally embedded with technologies that have the potential to dehumanize us, even perhaps destroy us. Now, you might think that that's an overstatement, but I'm going to go to some slides here at the end that I wanted to show you. This is an article just from May 2018. This has to do with gene editing, DIY gene editing. What we're talking about here is it's called CRISPR. Maybe you've heard this name, right. CRISPR.
Yeah.
CRISPR-Cas9. And without going into too detailed, it's a very simple thing that's happened. Okay, so I got sick. I really got sick. I get sick, and I'm not sick now. Now, no one who has this virus can make me sick again. Now, this is one of the things that's happened to us, that our immune systems, we have an immune system that can be trained to, once you've been exposed to something, to make it so you can't get that same virus again. So I'm free, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't have to wash my hands or anything. I'm not going to say that. Bacteria, it turns out, are amazingly complex organisms. They too have an immune system.
Right.
And when a virus comes and injects its RNA into the bacteria, right, it's there, and then the bacterium then mounts a response to it. And one of the things it does is that it clips out a little bit of the DNA that was injected in there, and attaches it to its own DNA as a memory log. It's like it's keeping a memory log of the viruses that are being put in there. This can have a long list of them, short clips in there, right? So there's a mechanism called Cas9, right, that does that. It scans, it somehow scans the DNA, takes it out, and inserts it. So now you have here, the people who did this suddenly discovered that this is a simple way, using this technology that the bacterium has developed for us, of snipping out pieces of DNA and inserting pieces of DNA. This is something that James Watson thought would take generations and generations to ever get to this point. And it hasn't taken that long. So we now have the capacity to do gene editing very easily, and this is what I didn't realize until May, really, of just how easy, right? So here it is. After a virus is created from mail-order DNA, scientists are sounding the alarm about genetic tinkering. So these are quotes from the article. So the most pressing worry is that someone somewhere will use the spreading technology to create a bioweapon. Already a research team at the University of Alberta has recreated from scratch an extinct relative of smallpox, horsepox, by stitching together fragments of mail-order DNA in just 6 months for $100,000, without a glance from law enforcement officials. $100,000, DIY gene editing kit, and they created a virus that they then were able to replicate. It was actually replicating. They got it to replicate. And all this time, you know, there's been this nail-biting, anxious sort of moral agonizing over whether or not we should destroy the last two samples of smallpox, right? Well, that's all out the window. It doesn't matter. Why? Because you can create smallpox. You know, you can now create the smallpox virus. You don't have to worry about destroying the last bits of them. This should be a concern to us. So it says, I have no doubt that someone is going to get hurt, he said. This is Josiah Zahner. He's a kid who people are trying to one-up each other, and it's moving faster than any of us could have ever imagined. It's almost uncontrollable. It's scary. That's this kid. He almost flunked out of high school, because he was, from the age of 13 or so, just completely taken up with the idea of creating a virus and so on. He was kicked out of a science fair project because he was doing genetic engineering. Right? He's now a research fellow at Stanford. His mission at Stanford is to build a body of genetic material for public use. To his fellow biohackers, it's a noble endeavor. To biosecurity experts, it's tossing ammunition into trigger-happy hands.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If nefarious biohackers were to create a biological weapon from scratch, a killer that would bounce from host to host to host, capable of reaching millions of people, unrestrained by time or distance, they would probably begin with some online shopping. A site called Science Exchange, for example, serves as a Craigslist for DNA, a commercial ecosystem connecting almost anyone with online access and a valid credit card to companies that sell cloned DNA fragments. There are really only two things that could wipe 30 million people off the planet, a nuclear weapon or a biological one, said Lawrence Gostin, an advisor on pandemic influenza preparedness to the World Health Organization. Somehow, the U.S. government fears and prepares for the former, but not remotely for the latter. It baffles me. Mm-hmm. We are not ready for this technology to be just out there with on Craigslist.
Why say the U.S. government?
Pardon?
It's a worldwide problem.
Absolutely.
I don't get the U.S. government quote there. That makes no sense.
Is anybody else prepared?
Well, I don't think that this quote means that only the U.S. should be concerned.
Well, that's the point.
Yeah, well, one of the points is here is that even if we were concerned with it...
It didn't matter.
So, now, I think the point here is that there's an inevitability to it.
Right.
Now, we're people of faith, right? What does it mean to be a person of faith? And this is where we'll do our case study and talk in small groups here in a second. What does it mean to be a person of faith in a situation where we may come to the conclusion that there's stuff that's going to be happening that we can't stop? What does it mean? Right? That's what it means. That's the question. And I call it, argumentum ad inexorabilum, meaning the argument from inexorability. In other words, it's a logical fallacy. Sometimes people will identify with the technology, not because they endorse it, but because they believe it's inevitable, even mounting arguments in its favor to try and convince them that it's not as bad as it is. On Monday, I showed a couple of clips that illustrated that in culture, modern culture. One is Lilo and Stitch, if you know this movie. It's Lilo and Stitch a while ago, where they created a little genetically engineered monster that eventually gets tamed and is converted, right? And it's called the Stockholm Syndrome, right? Where you identify with the people who've been hijacked, who hijacked you and are threatening your life. You identify with them because you're out of control, you're helpless, you have no ability to do anything about it, and so you somehow identify with that. I would like to think that being a person of faith is something other than that, right? Mm-hmm. Same with our phones, same with all the technologies that we have. So if we're going to, what I'd like to do now then is to actually do this, show this clip from Gattaca, the film. How many of you have seen Gattaca? Yeah, okay, very simple, simply, that this film is about two brothers. One is conceived in a natural way, right? And with all of the chance that goes with that. And the implication is that if you have the technology to fix stuff, it's irresponsible to have a child in the old-fashioned way of just having sexual intercourse and playing, like playing Russian roulette is the implication. That there's a moral imperative to take on the genetic technologies, and there's something wrong about just having a natural childbirth. Right? So they have a child in the second time, feeling guilty about having had a child naturally the first time. They have a child the second time who's genetically altered, genetically engineered. Right? So the whole movie is about the story between those two. And here's the one of the scenes from it. And I'm going to pass out the transcript of this little scene right here, and then we'll talk about it.
I was conceived in a Riviera, not the French Riviera, the Detroit variety. Hmm. You say that a child conceived in love has a greater chance of happiness. They don't say that anymore. I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Early fatal potential. Life expectancy, 30.2 years. The name of the certificate?
Hello. Vincent Anton.
Life-threatening.
I'm sorry, the insurance won't cover. If he fell,
but I was told that everything was
good. I really wish there was something I could do.
Like most of their parents of their day, they were determined that their next child would be brought into the world in what has become the natural way.
Your extracted eggs, 3, have been fertilized with Antonio sperm. After screening, we are left as received with 2 healthy boys and 2 very healthy girls. Naturally, no critical predispositions to any major inheritable diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate. First, we may as well decide on gender. Have you given it to me?
We would want Vincent's little brother, you know, playing with
him. Of course you would. Hello, Vincent. You have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, fairs. I take the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions. Premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, and addictive susceptibility, domestic violence, obesity.
So. We didn't want, diseases, yes, but.
Right. We were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to the chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have nothing to actually build in already. The child is in need of additional burdens. And keep in mind, this child is still you. Simply the best of you. You could conceive naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result.
Okay. There is a lot in that little dialogue there. But first here you've got the car, the variety of the Riviera there. And so what are they doing there? Having sex?
Yeah.
That's
what's another way to say it?
Reproducing,
that's right. They're reproducing. This is how you reproduce. It looks like they're in a committed partnered relationship, and there's love and all kinds of good stuff going there. What are they doing here?
Reproducing.
They're reproducing. They're fully clothed, intensive, you know, in this room, getting information from the doctor and so on. So here's what I'd like to do, is if you could sort of turn your chairs and pass this around. One per person is okay with this, but it's not around. So yeah, groups of, you know, three or four or five. So I'm just going to go through here. I'll just read this quickly out loud, and then you can then talk with each other and see what comes to the top for you. Things that you notice about this dialogue.
Are you going to join us?
All right. So I was conceived in Riviera, not the French Riviera, the Schottweiler. They used to say that a child conceived in love has a greater chance of happiness. Well, they don't say that anymore. Again, this is post hoc, him looking back at the decisions that his mother made that she could have made differently. I never understood what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter, not now. Now only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known. Bit of an exaggeration, but you get the point. Nurse, exactly, you know, neurological conditions, and it turns out in this case, early fatal potential, life expectancy, 30 years. The father then is upset and says, 30 years? The nurse says, what's the name for the certificate? The mother says, Anton. They were planning on naming this kid after his father. Anton then says, no, Vincent Anton, yeah, it's a good name. So he changes his mind about naming this kid, who now is only going to live 30 years, naming him Anton instead. Names him Vincent. And then Marie says, I know you will do something. You'll do something. Already treating him as somebody who's in trouble. He wants to protect him. And you'll do something. You know, even though this terrible thing has happened, you'll do something. The baby crying. Okay, Marie, Vincent, calling out. Vincent was running and falling down. From an early age, I came to think of myself as others thought of me, chronically ill. Every skin, knee, and runny nose was treated as if it were life-threatening. This is what the psychologists call labeling. You tell somebody hard enough and long enough and clear enough that they are something, they tend to take on those characteristics themselves. Child care woman, I'm sorry the insurance won't cover it. He fell. So insurance, you know, what isn't a pre-existing condition once we know all this stuff about genetics? So maybe insurance is not going to be the way forward. Marie, but I was told that everything would be, I really wish there was something I could do, claim. Narrator, like most of the parents of the day, they determined that their next child, and they want to make the mistakes they made before, would be brought into the world of what has become the natural way. So the doctor said, we've extracted your eggs, Marie, and have been fertilized with Antonio's sperm. After the screening, we're left, as you see, with 2 healthy boys, 2 very healthy girls, naturally no critical predisposition to any major inherited diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate. First, we may as well decide on gender. Have you given it any thought? So this is, again, a choice. Gender is the choice you make, whether you're going to have a male or a female fetus. We would want Vincent to have a brother, you know, to play with. And the doctor, well, of course you would. Hello, Vincent. Doctor, now you have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, fair skin, so you have this balding black doctor, you know, he wants fair skin. I have taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions, not just major inheritable diseases, but premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, addictive susceptibility, tendency to violence, obesity, and such. I don't want any of those things there, if you can avoid it, right? We didn't want, I mean, diseases, yes, but we were just wondering if good to just leave a few things to chance. Sort of the last distillate of a memory, Riviera, right? The last, you know, wanting to recapture something of what it means to reproduce in the old way. You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already. And if you noticed in the clip, that's when she looks kind of convincing. You have enough imperfection built in already. Your son, you did that. Your child doesn't need any additional burdens. And keep in mind, this child is still you, simply the best of you. You can conceive it naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result. So I'd like to, you know, if you could just discuss a little bit of what really pops out to you in this transcript, and then we'll talk about it together. This is not one of those groups where I have to worry about awkward silence.
More effective.
This is great. All right, let's just get some ideas, some things that are floating to the top in your discussions. Often you start on one thing and you realize you're really working your way through to something more important than what you start out with. But let's see, just hop out in the back. What came to the top in your discussion back there?
One of the things I thought about is the people who will be able to access this technology are the highly educated people with means. Those are the ones who will access it. And there's going to be a big population of people that's going to be left out.
This illustrates, Postman's point is that technologies never affect everyone equally. There's going to be winners and losers, and in this kind of technology, you're suggesting that one of the implications is that it's going to be, the people who have the means to be able to provide themselves with the same trait advantages that are successful, right? And you concentrate those and so on. And, right. Okay. Yes.
And that reminds me of something that is very interesting. It's a government who decides that, because think of the telephone and the electricity and how our government decided they wanted everyone to have one. And so, it's almost 100 years old, but most of us here can remember when the rural, you had phones that were not private, and you may or may not have even had electricity out in the hinterlands.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that, please? No, she can't. She can, I think, but it's got to be louder and facing other direction.
I think what you're saying here is that
the government has the finances to be able to decide who can access the technology. Our government chose to give us electricity and telephones in the last century, and that's a good example of how the government gave it to everybody.
And I suppose your point in this case is that these are technologies which are very, at this point, they're still quite esoteric, very expensive, and so therefore, assuming that they aren't going to be regulated, well, first of all, your point about boundaries and what do international boundaries mean today, right? With the internet in particular, what does it mean to have a boundary at all, right? If you have a regulation in the United States that bans this kind of thing, what are you going to do? Go to another country where you get what you want, right? There's always going to be somewhere, somebody who's going to be able to give you what you want. So you're saying that in this case, that the technologies are going to be advantages, particularly these are self-engineered, these are engineerings of ourselves, right, that are going to accumulate, this is your claim, that possibly it's going to then advantage an increasingly small number of people. Yeah.
Well, a combination of these two ideas is the people who have the money will be the alphas from Brave New World, and the people who don't have the money will get a government-sponsored one, so you can breed enough people who will work, who will be the Zetas?
The Deltas.
The Deltas, yes. The Deltas. It's a possibility everybody could benefit from it, but they'll be in a place.
Yes, in very different ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gattaca is about that phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Your hand up is definitely up here.
In terms of the international boundaries, biblically, one of the things in the Old Testament with all the Levitical laws were the needs of the community being more important than the rights of any individual. But right now we live in a country, or maybe we live in a world, where the rights of the individual are ascendant. And so how do we deal with things that will affect either positively or negatively the whole community when we're focused on the right of either an individual or an individual nation?
Yeah, and how to connect that up with the case?
Well, the case would be the idea of you can go to another country and get what you want,
I see,
versus here. And somehow we have to have a more global consensus, if we can, on some of these things.
Yeah, yeah. It's really boundaries are, borders are a deep conceptual muddle right now, problematic. And I would think too, as persons of faith, that we think of, in Christ there is no male nor female, slave nor free, black nor rich, and none of that stuff matters. And these truths, we hold these truths to be self-evident. well, self-evident so long as you're a citizen of the United States. You know, in other words, our ideals seem to be very, you know, universal, right? But we seem to then have this puzzle that we seem to need to have boundaries, and those things that we're proclaiming as being universal values seem to only apply for people who have certain, you know, the right passport.
White male and a property owner, when those were promulgated.
And believe me, I'm not suggesting any policy decisions based on anything I'm saying here. I'm just describing the problem here. Yeah.
The other thing I thought is this is, we're on the trajectory to this. So what do we do to make this be, to help this be more for the good than the bad? Or how do we respond to what is, in many ways, inevitable?
Well, let me challenge you with it. Adrienne Ash is a bioethicist. She's blind, bioethicist. And I got to meet her at Dartmouth when we were preparing for our project with the NIH. And we, in fact, got into a couple of pretty strong kind of batting ideas back and forth in these discussions we had around the question of what makes an inability to do something a disability, with all the connotations of someone having a disability, right? And she ends up, with a rather, maybe because, in part because of her blindness, but she came up with a theory that, you know, that led her to the conclusion there should be no genetic testing. And she gives no prenatal genetic tests. And here's her argument. She has two arguments for it. You can agree with it or disagree with it, throw it away or absorb it. But here's her arguments, is that, first of all, it's a moral affront to people with disabilities to do an abortion based on a genetic test. It's basically saying to the world of people who have disabilities, it's saying, if we could, we would live in a world without you the way that you are. This is what it means to have an abortion based on a genetic test from her point. The second thing is, which is, I think, easier for us to understand as a community of faith, is that it represents a profound misunderstanding of what it means to be a parent. That being a parent is not protecting your kid from all possible suffering. And the technologies, here's this guy saying that, you know, well, you don't want your kid to be bald, you don't want him to have myopia. You know? So imagine how hard it would be. I don't know how many of you are parents. How many of you are parents? Okay, we're all parents. It, you know, I can go through this and think of 1,000 reasons why this is wrong and that I would never want to go through this to be making decisions in this kind of way. Because my kid, this guy standing there, he's saying, you know, we eliminate the predisposition to addictivity or obesity and things. What am I going to do? In other words, is this guy's arguments in here, how would you get in a position to argue against him when the person you're arguing with is a potential parent, you know? Yeah. And I don't know how to do that.
Well, there's...
So, but the point, I mean, the main point I wanted to get at before we go is just this idea of what it means to be a human being, and that somehow, through all this, we're losing touch with clear thinking about what it means to be a human being, and what's a counter and what's not a counter. And for us to have this kind of paranoid preoccupation with the avoidance of all forms of suffering, that by in doing that, we somehow are eliminating that which makes us distinctively human. The suffering with your child through inevitable, the suffering with your child, you know, in the inevitable suffering that they're going to go through, is part of what it means for us to be a human being, it strikes me, as a person of faith. Yes?
But on the other side of that is, okay, are you not going to vaccinate your child?
Right.
Or are you not going to do good nutrition that we now know, because we've learned that if you nutritionally take care of a pregnant woman, her risk for having a child with mononucleosis disappears because you give her the right supplement. And somebody discovered that, and so you made that difference. I'm not advocating that this is right, or this can give you statistics, and we should make all your decisions. But at the same time, we have made some really thoughtful improvements, and are any of us suffering from having had vaccines? We remember having measles. Did we want our children to have measles?
Polio,
smallpox. I mean, so it's at a different level technologically. It's a next step up, but you can't simply go, oh, I refuse it all.
It's a very, very sharp two-edged sword.
It is.
Right? Very sharp. And if the article that I quoted you before is anywhere near accurate, it's scary. Yeah, it's scary. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hopefully we can learn something from history. Isn't this what Hitler tried to do?
Yeah.
A little bit.
I think that the problem when we're in a scary, as it's like 9/11, right? I don't know. I guess you're old enough to remember 9/11. The problem with being scared, Maslow's hierarchy of needs thing, the more scared you are, the more willing you are to give up control.
Well, I'm not thinking in terms of being scared. I'm thinking of creating a perfect society. Isn't that what Hitler wanted to do?
Right, but to do that, he created the Jews, the demon, the source of things, so that, that somehow, and he took over control. You know, that, that the only way to get problems solved and get them solved now is to be a deal maker, like Donald Trump or somebody, right? Yeah. So this is exactly what Plato said about democracy. He said, if you don't have education commensurate with the seriousness of the exercise of democracy, it's not going to succeed. And all of us, it's like with Neil Postman, it's myth. Democracy is mythic to us. It's like part of nature. We grew up with it. We say we'll live and die for it and all that. It's fragile. And I don't know how to get through to my students now that it's, don't assume that this is, that that's the, but what Plato said is that if you don't have education commensurate with the seriousness of the exercise of democracy, you'll end up with someone who is very, very rich, who knows nothing about politics controlling the planet. That's exactly what he said. It was a democracy that killed Socrates. So that's why when I say two-edged sword is that when we get Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that we become willing to solve a problem. We're gonna, like here, if it could get worse and worse here, the you might at some point, we're all friendly now, we're talking to each other, but if you began to see me as a potential threat, like this was typhoid or something, I could see you changing your mind about this and locking me in some room and, and putting the food under the door. And, we end up doing things to maintain our basic sense of safety by allowing ourselves to give up control. That's really what I'm all about as an educator at this point with my students, is trying to get them to feel like they can stand up, shoulders back, to do difficult things, and to act in the world to make some difference, and not get lost in the feeling of helplessness that we have.
I think you agree. Benjamin Franklin said it very well. If you're willing to give up a little liberty for more safety, we'll end up with neither.
That's exactly right. But What for me the last time I was at Holden was a conceptual kind of problem is now for me an immediate existential problem that I spend most of my waking hours thinking about. And I guess I don't know who Steven Pinker is, but he wrote a book saying just how well off we are relatively speaking from the rest of the history of the world in terms of wars and people dying and longevity and all that. But then he goes on to write a recent book called Enlightenment Now, which is sort of an offset to that, saying all that may be true, but we're still very much at a great risk of losing it all. Yeah. If we can't get control over our decision making about what we're going to do with these technologies that we're now embedding themselves in our psyche. Yeah.
Quick question. Does your friend, the blind person, was talking about the difference? There's a difference between selecting an embryo, in my mind, and picking something that, if you have, for example, a genetic disease that you don't want passed along to your children, as opposed to having an abortion based on something that you don't want to select out of. Is there a difference in her mind at all between
Two quick things to say about it. I worry about the clock as though you have another class to go to. First of all, that the abortion debate of the 60s and 70s had nothing to do with this, right? In other words, it's one thing to say, I don't want anyone to have control over my body and whether or not I reproduce. Right? That's a discussion. To say that I want to have a child, but I don't want to have that one. I don't want to have that one, or that one. I might want to have someone here, but I would prefer someone, you see what I'm saying? This is where the IVF and all that stuff is taking us. You have IVF combined with genetic technology, you end up with, first, with abortion, selective abortions based on genetic tests, and then finally, with CRISPR in the embryo, being able to construct and create. They've already gotten people, you know, injecting themselves with genetic material, trying to make themselves stronger, and so on. It was the second point I was going to make, but that's all I can think of now. And there was something else there, though, that was, oh, only that what she's trying to say to me that's kind of profound, and I've thought a lot about this with my teaching in ethics, is that the avoidance of suffering, often in bioethics literature, it's sort of accepted that one has a moral obligation to reduce suffering. Mm-hmm. And that's turned into a kind of logical fallacy, I think, that suffering itself is a reason not to do something, where, in fact, it may be simply something that a person needs and ought to go through. Mm-hmm. There was a woman, a hospital case where a woman was going to have a fetus that was going to be dead. It was a trisomy disorder that was terrible. It wasn't going to survive birth, right? And they decided she also had herpes, active vaginal herpes. And she elected to not resuscitate the infant, you know, give it birth and not resuscitate it. They then had to decide between doing cesarean or a vaginal birth. It's much safer to do the vaginal birth. So she agreed to do that, and they knew they were not going to resuscitate. So the herpes didn't matter. In other words, with the vaginal birth of the herpes. So she decided to go through that because it was safer. And then she gave birth, and something happened that no one expected. What do you think happened?
The child
goes, wah. They didn't expect there to be a cry. It was still in the same situation. It just gave a little cry, wah. And all of a sudden, this woman who had decided not to have the baby, all of a sudden, she was a mother now. And nothing was going to stop her from giving every instant, no matter what the suffering was for the child or for her. She was going to be there holding that child till it died in her arms, right? And guess what? It got herpes and got in the brain and died 2 weeks later. So, but I guess my point is that we don't seem to fully absorb the paradox of suffering and realize that sometimes suffering is exactly where a particular person at a particular point in time in their particular life needs to be. And this is what
is crucible,
desperately,
really.
Desperately needed. And I want to say that is an act of faith. This is what faith, you know, if she responded to that as a mother, and nothing was going to stop her from holding that child till it died. Going through the suffering with her instead of avoiding the suffering, of dealing with it all. And by saying, well, I don't want to have my kid suffer, so I'm going to let it die, right? Mm-hmm. Well, half of that is going to be, well, you know what? I don't want to go through that either, right? I don't want to go through the suffering and seeing it suffer. Well, maybe we're built to see that and to experience that in some ways, and that we're at a loss because we don't, right? That's
and sometimes suffering can be a crucible that separates it. If you can skim off the impurities in the, and it can be a positive. Suffering can have a positive.
Right. So I've invented this logical fallacy called argumentum ad miserium, you know, which means the argument from suffering, and saying it's a logical fallacy. It's a logical fallacy to say that we shouldn't do something because it will cause suffering. I just think it's a logical fallacy. I see that as a direct consequence of reflecting on my own experience of suffering, mm-hmm. and also being a person of faith.
I think there's a tremendous validity in that.
I'm sorry, can you speak up, please?
I think there's a tremendous validity in that because if we don't look at failure in something as suffering, look at what happens and has happened with the kids who are never allowed to fail at their soccer game or never allowed to come in second or third. You know, we want them to learn to compete, but we also they need to learn how to fail so that they know how to go on to do the next thing. It's a form of suffering. And so I have to think that there is a certain amount of that has to happen for us to succeed as human beings.
Yeah, I mean, every year I see my students after 30 years teaching, you know, for going on the other side and have all that, but 30 years, students come to college more and more anxious. the anxiety level goes up, the people with disabilities, you know, that are psychologically induced have gone up, right? That, and I think at least in part, this is again simplistic, but in part they've been sedated by technology, you know, the technologies that, and also they have been deprived of what I would call more sort of tough, realistic kind of pictures that need to be presented about life, to learn how to, you know, to rise up, stand up, stay, and learn to do difficult things, even if it might cost them suffering. Right? They don't know. They respond to that message too. This last spring, I did a course where they really responded to that message, doing that we're built for difficult things.
Okay. Technology's right.
So we're supposed to put it 12, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry to keep you.
Food started at 11:45, but we thought you were better.
Food was supposed to start at 11:45.
It's still there.
Okay. Thank you. It's a relief to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.